Hello, everyone. My name is Ryan Griggs, and I'm the host of the Virginia Sounds podcast. And alongside me today is Sam with Sweetwater Farm and Ranch Co. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, good to be here, Ryan.
So I guess
I'm not used to being on. Not used to being on a microphone. So hopefully this goes well. You know,
definitely. I mean, this is the great thing about the podcast I'm doing is. I don't know, it's just like an everyday conversation and wanting to hear y'all's stories, especially because in today's age, that's not really a thing right now. So yeah, I guess with that, then what would be the impetus behind starting Sweetwater Farm and Ranch Co.?
Well, man, there's layers to that, but I guess I'll start with how we ended up here. So my parents wanted to get out of the city like 30 years ago. They were living on Ventura County, and it was just getting really bad with homelessness and gangs and violence and all that. And my mom had some friends up here in Tuolumne County in California, which is the same county that Yosemite's in, for anyone that's listening. It's Central Sierras. So they looked at a bunch of different properties and decided to get this 170-year-old abandoned ranch and moved up here. And my mom, my dad owned a custom home building thing. So he built like really fancy houses for really fancy people. And then my mom bred and raised show horses. So now you see it on Yellowstone, they spin and they slide and they trot and they do all the pretty stuff. But that's expensive. So when the recession happened, there wasn't any money in horses. So the horses went the way of the buffalo, I guess. They're gone now. And then because of the recession and because the community we're in is so poor, I tried for 2 or 3 years to get a job and no one would hire me. You know, are you going to hire some 17, 18-year-old or are you going to hire the 40-year-old dude with 3 kids? You know, I'd hire the dude with kids all day long. So I ended up joining the Army because I didn't know what else to do. And they were the only people that were hiring. My little brother was kind of in the same situation. So when he got out of high school, he did the same thing. I said, hey, look for a job, figure it out for a year. If you still want to join, just don't join a combat job like I did because these people are insane. So I came back from that and we bumped around here for a little bit. And back then, medical marijuana in California was a really big thing. So I fell out of the Army. I didn't really have a plan. I was kind of just wandering around and I wandered into these medical marijuana people. And I started working for them on pot farms. And then that started connecting dots with practices they were using to things I did as a teenager with my dad, as far as regenerations of soils and growing our own crops and doing all that stuff. So the marijuana growers were implementing a lot of these same regenerative practices, and it kind of connected some dots for me. So then they legalized weed in California, and that was its own thing. It basically cannibalized the industry. So an industry that was making money and actually creating jobs was cannibalized by its own legalization, which is a thing in and of itself. So anyway, that also went the way of the buffalo. And then I went to college to use my GI Bill in San Francisco, and I was going for business management and marketing. And I was like one class away from having my bachelor's, and COVID started. So I came back here. Me and my brother had already been talking about doing some type of farm. We'd already started the LLC, Sweetwater Farm and Ranch Company. And, there wasn't a lot to do at that time, so we just kind of went for it.
Interesting. So with that, then, whenever you're saying you went for it, what was that process like? Did you just start researching, or how did you just start, essentially?
So we'd been doing some research for a while. You know, like I said, we did some farming during the recession. We had to eat and we were too bootstrapped for cash to really get much from the grocery store. So we started raising cows and chickens and eggs and that whole thing and growing a lot of our own crops. So we already had some idea of what we were doing. Plus, we grew up in a very agriculturally minded area. So we kind of had an idea. Me and my brother sat down on the phone and ran the numbers and decided that pigs were going to be better for us than cows or chickens or anything else to start. They breed two or three times a year. They have a lot of babies, and they don't need nearly as much space as a cow needs to raise. They also grow a lot faster, and it's a lot less capital intensive to get started. So then we really experimented with a few different breeds of pigs, raising them the way that we wanted, having them slaughtered, trying the meat out, doing the whole hog thing for a year or two during COVID, just selling to friends and neighbors and stuff to try to figure out what kind of meat that we wanted and how that process with the USDA worked and how to make everything legal. So we kind of got that figured out, and we decided to go and try to go for something that was a little bit larger scale, which we did with no money, which is really hard to do, as we found out. So we decided that we were going to start doing commercial sales. So like restaurants, grocery stores, and try to do more direct to consumer stuff. And at the end of 2021, I think. Yeah. And so there was a lot of figuring out logistics and how all that works. And we're just getting now to a point where we've streamlined a lot of that stuff. We understand cut how and when to get things cut. We understand our cash flows really well. And that's kind of the business side of it, which is a lot of what I do now, which sucks because I really like the farming aspect more, but we just don't have the manpower to have somebody else run the business too. But it's finding the animals. So we decided on what kind of pigs is, what's the most popular breed of pig? Well, that would be the pink one. Then you have like red wattles, and you have Hampshires, and then Berkshires are harder to find. And we decided on Berkshires. The meat is always awesome. They take a little bit longer to raise. They're kind of a boutique breed that isn't really on the commercial market. So we kind of weighed all those different options and decided that if we were going to do something, it needed to be a little boutique-y, and it needed to be somewhat exclusive for our area, and that might give us an edge with growth. Because the other side of it is, you know, we don't want our kids, and you know, we want to create some jobs here and some hope and some stuff that's been gone from our community for a long time because of how poor it is. I mean, the 2008 recession never really ended here, you know, and then it was just getting better and COVID started and it all went back to the way it was, which is just extreme poverty for most people. So that's part of it too, is we want to give back to the land. We want to get people healthy food, and we want to create some good jobs and some hope for at least a few people.
It's interesting to hear too, just because it makes me think of Will Harris and how he's trying to do that exact. I mean, he is helping out a lot with that exact same situation in Bluffton. I mean, that's just the very unfortunate, similar crisis around America to where, especially in the rural areas, have just been decimated. The farm I worked on in Pennsylvania in the fall of 2022, yeah, a lot of the areas that we would help serve, a lot of the customers were on essentially food stamps. I forgot the name of the program off the top of my head, but it's, I don't know where I'm going with that, but it's just interesting.
No, I mean, I can caveat off of that really easy, you know. In the Army, I spent time in South Carolina and Oklahoma and Texas, and I've driven all over the country, and you know, it's really sad when you drive through these towns, and there's a bunch of them. You could just pick any highway, right? But you'll drive through a town, and there's 1,000 abandoned homes and a gas station and a fucking $2 Generals. There's always $2 Generals. And you're like, well, what happened to this community? Obviously, at one point, this was a thriving community. And, you know, as we've learned more about what happened in the agricultural space, I think a big part of that is when those agriculture go away and those farms started to sell out and go away, and that money became more consolidated, and you know, then you add in inflation and all these other things, it just became economically unviable to stay in those places where those people had already lived, and so they just abandoned all those buildings. But it's nationwide. I mean, any rural community is full of abandoned buildings because there's nobody to live in them, and if they do live in them, they're too poor to fix them.
I'm curious then, with your area through just the various different times, what was the reasoning behind just staying versus going elsewhere to potential more promising opportunities?
Being in California, that's a loaded question. There's a huge egress of people right now. You know, my dad really considered leaving during the recession. I mean, he could have got a much better job at the company he worked for down in LA County. But he'd already put so much into this place, and it was really hard on him to do this. And then my mother passed away, and he just dug his heels in and, you know, managed to save this ranch somehow and keep it in our family and keep it paid, keep paying the mortgage and doing all the things that most people just walked away from at that time. So that's kind of what's committed us to staying here. The other side of that is my family on both sides has been in California for a very long time. You know, my oldest ancestor on my mom's side sailed around South America, landed in San Francisco, and failed as a gold miner, you know. And then the oldest ancestor in California on my dad's side fell off the boat from Ireland. Got drafted for the Civil War, even though he'd been in America for a year. And then he found his way in California after the war. And then, so both of those groups of people have been here a long time. And we just think that, you know, this is where we're from and we're not going to leave. And it's up to us to try to make it better, you know.
I'm curious for you yourself, at the time of when you were in the military and then coming back, and then paired with what you were mentioning with your father wanting to just stay and continue working on that, did you also just feel compelled to just wanting to help with the ranch long term, or was just something that, again, you were just trying to figure out everything with your life and this just seemed like a good opportunity to work, but then also figure things out?
You know, we wanted to save the place, and my dad was getting old, and it was really, he was going to die. He was going to work himself to death. And so we had to find something else that wasn't building homes. That was part of it. Part of it was just, we're really lucky. We have a beautiful plot of land with a storied history. I mean, my house that I live in here is, it was built in 1850. You know, it's got a quartz rock foundation on a huge part of the house, and we're trying to renovate it, but it's a big house and there's a lot wrong with it. And for me staying, it was really just trying to save this place. You know, because what me and my brother saw our father go through to keep it, for us to let it go away because he was too old now to keep paying for it. That just wouldn't sit right with me, if that makes sense.
Definitely. No, I can relate to that. With going back to just once you had all, you started with the pigs, did you have those for the commercialized with the restaurants and grocery stores? Was that with the pigs?
Yeah, so I think what you're asking is, did we have the pigs to sell to the grocery stores and restaurants?
Yeah, I guess what was that process like whenever you were just trying to figure all that out starting out?
That process has been a mess, and luckily we've been very lucky to have a good partner who has all the Berkshires that we could ever need. And his family's been raising them for five generations, but they stopped being able to get what they needed to raise them. So he's just been selling fair pigs forever. So we've started buying pigs from him of all different sizes as we need them. And part of that is financial. You know, we need to build a big farrowing barn here. We do breed the pigs that we can, but without the proper facilities, it's a mess. And we're stuck in a, because I mentioned earlier that my mother passed away. So we've been stuck in a probate for 18 months of the 3 years we've been selling commercially. And so we've just been stuck in this cycle of, yeah, we have the space, but our facilities aren't quite what they need to be. And so we've been lucky with being able to bring out pigs of different sizes as we've needed to increase our production. And I know one thing that a lot of the direct-to-consumer farms really struggle with is logistics, because, you know, everybody wants the bacon or the tenderloin or the prime rib, but nobody wants the bones and the chuck and the ground beef. And so we found ourselves scaling up again really fast. I mean, we thought we were probably going to be doing 5 to 10 pigs a month in like 2026. And we started off doing 5 pigs a month. And then within 2 months, we were doing 10 pigs a month. And then that became 15 pigs every 45 days. And then that became 30 pigs every 60 days. And we've kind of stuck to that 30 pigs every 60 days for about a year. And then we opened up into the Bay Area, so San Francisco, Oakland, Palo Alto, and then also the Sacramento area. And that's required us to do, just to meet the logistical needs of those different clients and to supply them with a steady enough supply of meat that they can count on us to have product for them consistently. Us to go from 30 pigs every 60 days to 35 pigs every 30 days. And keep in mind, that's without any special financing or big bank loan. And so when we first decided we were going to do the Bay Area thing, that was back in October. So we had to have more pigs brought out here so that we could raise them over the winter and get this process rolling for, I think our first month was this month. March was our first month of doing that. And there are a few things went wrong. There were some pay issues from clients. You know, there was a cutting issue at the cutting house, but I think you can't do any big expansion without having some hiccups. And so now we're rolling into this. We kind of rolled the dice on this. Every dollar we could scrounge together, everything we could do to get this rolling. And we're rolling into the second month right now. We actually took in another 35 hogs last night. That's why I look a little disheveled. I'm tired, man. Another thing about where we're at is we're the end of the internet. So we're the very last place that gets high-speed internet in our area.
Yeah.
The last house. So it can get a little tricky. But what I was saying, are we recording again?
Yeah, no, you're good. Okay, no.
What I was saying was that the... So we have to drop off at night, which sucks for us because we're working all day, you know, and there's only 4 people that work here. And then we have like 4 people that volunteer that want to get jobs as soon as we can afford to hire them. But we're doing sales and deliveries and production runs and raising all the animals and doing all these different things and maintaining the property and paying all the bills and tracking down all the money, which can be a huge problem. And so... we have to drop off in the middle of the night because the guys in the semi trucks were running over too many vegan protesters during the day. I swear to God. So they make you drop off at night because apparently people don't protest at night. So there's been no issues since they required all hog drop offs to take place at night. But I swear to God, that's why.
Yeah.
Because apparently no one will come out and protest if they're late for the jam band session or the dive bar or whatever. Then I can't protest if I'm supposed to be out doing that, but I can protest if, and that's probably mean, but that's the way I see it. You know, you're so committed to something, but you're not willing to commit to it after hours. Okay.
I'm curious for the drivers themselves.
I mean, think about it like this, you know, think about how people have road rage normally. And normal people that probably wouldn't have road rage because their brain is processing so much information so quickly that everything is high stress. And so what's happening for these drivers is they've got a load of animals on that truck that might die in transport. Pigs really don't transport well, especially commodity pigs like what's on those big semis. And now I don't think you should be raising pigs like that, but in that guy's mind, right, he's got $60,000 worth of pigs. He's driving a $150,000 truck. And here's some fucking guy, sorry for the cussing, here's some guy that smells like patchouli oil, living on daddy's money, and he's going to stand out here and tell him that this guy's entire way of life is wrong after he just drove 700 miles across three states to deliver these animals, you know, that might die while he's waiting for this guy to get out of the way. And so, you know, you've got all those things going on in that guy's mind, and a lot of them just run the barricade. And I think for a lot of the protesters, they don't realize how much it hurts to get hit by a car or that somebody would do that to them. And I ride motorcycles. I've been hit by a couple cars. It sucks. I can't imagine what it would feel like to get hit by a semi, even at 2 or 3 miles an hour. So obviously that's a huge liability for the processing plant. And that's why they switched to the nighttime slaughters.
You mentioned that pigs aren't great to travel with. Can you elaborate on why?
And I'm not going to get into animal intelligences too much, but I think it's, you know, pigs spook really easily. And they're also not transported like cows are. So a cow is much more likely to be transported throughout its entire life on a trailer. And sometimes yes and sometimes no. But so pigs don't load well. They panic easily. And they can't see the color black. So when trailer floors are black, they just assume it's a hole. So anything that's black, they think is just a hole into space, like there's nothing there. So like with our trailers, we actually we've had to paint the insides of them bright colors, so the pigs can see the inside of the trailer. Because when it's just black, like when we go to buy new trailers, hopefully this year, the new cool thing is those rubber cleats on the floor of the trailer. Well, the problem is if we're loading pigs, they see that rubber cleat and they turn around and they run back out because they think they're falling down a hole. So that's part of it. And the other thing is they just spook easily. So road noise is more likely to harm them. They'll just have heart attacks. Now with our animals, in the 4 years we've been doing this, I think we've lost 3 animals in transport. Which is really good for pigs. And those weren't animals that we lost transporting. We've never lost an animal transporting from the ranch. Those were feeder pigs coming out of our partner's place on the other side of the country that he was driving out to us. And then 2 of those, I think, were because he had 2 trailers tires blow up at the same time in Wyoming, and I think it just gave the pigs heart attacks, and they just don't trailer well. That's the best thing I can say about it. You want to make sure they have plenty of water. You don't really want to feed them, and they can't be in the trailer for more than 24 hours. Those are kind of the guidelines.
Why on the 24 hour rule? Why is that? What happens if they're in there for much longer?
It's just stress. So all that stress compounds over time. But on the other side of that, you know, I've loaded up the night before and stuff and taken them in at 2 or 3 in the morning and had them in there for 10 or 12 hours. And they just lay down and sleep. But, at the same time, if you've got a rowdy bunch, they'll fight in the back of the trailer and they scream and it's not pretty. And so they'll have heart attacks and die, or they'll squash each other to death or whatever. And that's really all I can say to that. You know, I wish I had a better answer. I just know that they're more prone to not doing well on the trailer, and we've done what we can to mitigate that, and it seems to be working. So, yeah.
So I'm curious then, with just the topic of logistics, and then especially as you're expanding to other areas, as you were mentioning in San Francisco and Sacramento area, if you could just highlight just the different types of logistics you have to go through for customers, because that's one thing that's not talked a whole lot, just for the people that are starting to learn about agriculture and just the food system and whatnot. Because, for example, with the huge explosion of raw milk coming to the scene, especially this year and the last year, it's just really had a huge explosion of growth. People always talk about just having milk deliveries and whatnot, which long term, I really want that for everywhere. But most don't understand how logistically insane it could be depending on where you're at, because there's so much that goes into it to ensure that you get the food. Yeah, so I'm curious if you could just talk about that process for just the different customers and the different areas that you serve.
Man, that's a whole podcast in and of itself.
I think
I'll try to keep that. Yeah, I know. I'd love to do another one where that's all we talk about, but I'll keep it brief because I could talk about that for an hour. Sometimes I drive my lady nuts because she wants to talk about her day, and I'm just talking about having this one logistical issue. Logistics is complex, especially as a small operation. You know, I wish the whole pig was made out of center cut loins and bacon, but it's just not. And so the question is, well, how many animals do I need to raise and how often do I need to have them slaughtered in order to facilitate enough sales of the good and bad products? And how do I balance that with the customers that I have and with the customers that I think I'm going to have? And that's a really unique question. And I think that Will Harris actually does a good job of answering that when people ask him, well, how much can you scale out white oak pastures, right? And he says, well, I can't answer that really, you know, because each area is different. And like, for instance, I'm quadruple over ordered on center cut loins for San Francisco. You know what I'm not over ordered on? Pig's feet. So, and then storage space is an issue. Like, we're going to have to get a bigger walk-in freezer because we can't store more than 35 animals a month. And trying to smooth out that logistics supply chain, I think, is it's a battle for every operation to do in their own way. Because when you're talking about boutique or farm to fork stuff, getting back to radically traditional farming or ranching, your supply chain should be short. Your production should be based off what your supply chain can support, and your production should be based off what it costs you to maintain that supply chain. And that's been the biggest issue for us, is always feeling like there's just one more step to get to the top of that hill. Oh, we just need this customer. Oh, we just need to do that. And it never seems to get there. But for us, being located in Central California, having access to markets that are just full of clients that appreciate what we can have, whether they're grocers or consumers or like restaurants, we've been very fortunate. You know, I know guys in the Midwest, a lot of them do the drop shipping because they don't have 20 Michelin star restaurants in one city that they can go talk to. You know, we can literally drive the product there every day. And we do, we go to San Francisco twice a week. We go to Sacramento once a week. And we try to keep people full of the products that they have or that they want. Another thing is we've been great to find some bigger, more established restaurant customers that understand that we're scaling up and that we can't fulfill everything. We can do 60, we can do 70% right now. OK, Okay. But they're willing to buy an entire batch of one product, which is great for me because I can cross that off my sales list and I can work on the things that are harder to sell. And they're willing to wait until we're big enough that we can support that whole supply chain then and fill their entire order for what they want. So we've been very fortunate in that aspect to have partnered with organizations that appreciate what we have, what we're doing, what we're trying to do. And because it's not cheap. It's not cheap to buy that kind of stuff from us. I mean, we're two or three times more expensive at a minimum than commodity pork is.
So that's interesting because, I mean, I know it ties to where you're at location wise, because I've heard many, many horror stories of trying to have relationships with local restaurants to where they change their expectations all of a sudden, or they cut you off all of a sudden, or, I mean, there's just so many different types of horror stories I've heard. I'm curious with your case, how do you start these relationships? And I'm just curious, yeah, what are these relationships like? Cause it seems different than what I typically hear with farms and restaurants.
So the way that we've approached it is, I don't know if steel sharpens steel is the right term, right? But so where we're at locally, being such a poor community, even finding a few customers up here was really hard to do. And we killed ourselves for 2 years trying to keep the food as local as possible, trying to get support from our super local restaurants. And we do have some, and they are amazing, amazing staff, amazing chefs, amazing owners. Those guys are awesome. But then there's also places I walk into where it's like, guys, I've been coming in here for 10 years. I know you all know me. You won't buy a case of ham steaks a month or whatever. You know, like that's kind of offensive. And there's lots of stuff like that. And then we had lots of guys sign on, buy one thing, say they were going to do all this. So we had a bunch of stuff done for them. And then they just dropped us out of nowhere. And that pressure and those failures made us really good at meet and greets, made us really good with our packaging, which is another thing. If you want to remind me to get into packaging and what that takes logistically, really good at cold calls, really good at market research. And it took a lot of trial and error. And it took a lot of practice to get good sales materials, good emails, good, have a great product that's packaged in a great way that's very consistent for those restaurants, understanding how and when to sell different customers what part of the pig. That all took a long time to learn. So by the time that we were in San Francisco, it was so hard for us to even get a single client locally. That by the time we got down there, it was a lot easier because we'd already had all that stuff figured out. And on top of that, there's a huge operation called Llano Seco that's in our Central California region, and they shut down. They just closed their doors. There was a legal change in California. It's called Prop 12 animals. It has to do with hog farrowing crates and animal welfare. And although I'm not pro-government intervention in anything, I think when you're talking about animal welfare or like worker rights, I think there's a certain place for that. And I think hog production in America, and in America is beautiful compared to what they do in China, but hog production in America is probably one of the most grotesque and inhumane animal production systems. And I know there's a thing going around with Tyson right now, and I'll say this too. I had a girlfriend that had had a checkered past. And at one point she'd been in jail somewhere in California. And part of her jail was she would go, in order to get out of jail, they sent her to Foster Farms. And she would have to take all the dead chickens out of the cages. So the Foster Farms chickens are raised with prison slave labor. And on top of that, they have to pull off their beaks and cut off their toes so they don't kill themselves. So chicken production and hog production are abysmal, and I think that there needs to be a lot of research into that process, because it's just, to me, it's ethically wrong. And that's Agreed. Not coming from somebody that is pro-government intervention. I am absolutely not. I bear the scars of government intervention, and literally.
You're spot on with the, I mean, that's partly why I was vegan for so long. It wasn't, I'd never watched any documentaries or anything, but I've seen some horrific videos and pictures and read a lot on factory farming. I mean, as you mentioned with the chickens, with pigs, they also would cut their tails off so they wouldn't bite them off. Horrific things. Plenty of posts. The last thing I wanted to add was there's these nasty lagoons that are surrounded with these huge pig farms, and I've posted about it a lot. They're just,
that post is actually how we found out about you.
Really?
Yeah, somebody sent me that. I think my cousin Chelsea sent me that, and she went, "Have you heard of these guys? Check this out. I did not know this at all." And I was like, "Well, yeah, we knew about it. I've just never seen a picture of it before." Those are crazy. And like last night, we're when we dropped the pigs off, we're not allowed to take pictures of anything. Part of that is because of the vegan protester thing. But another part of that is just because, and the animals that are coming in now after the implementation of Prop 12 are a lot better than the animals that were coming in last year. But, you know, our pigs come off the trailer and they're big and they're healthy and they've got well-developed muscles and they can run around and they walk right. And you're watching the pink pigs come off the big trailers and their muscles are underdeveloped. Their faces are underdeveloped. They can't walk, you know. And those pigs look great compared to the pigs that we were seeing last year. I mean, I've seen some horrible stuff come in. And that's just part of that commodity pork industry that I think as a society, we need to have a larger conversation about animal welfare, because animal welfare is human welfare, and we become what we're putting into our bodies, right?
That's also why for the longest time, I'd never bought pork in grocery stores. It's still better than vegan food, in my opinion, but a lot of the pork and stores is Smithfield Foods, and they are just a horrific organization that's now owned by China. Just some interesting things with all of that.
Yeah, and that goes back to what we were saying with the towns getting smaller, right? Because that money, those debt, those ghost towns, that money that built that town is now being funneled out to some CEO or some multinational billion-dollar corporation. Our product is more expensive, but when you buy from us, you're helping animal welfare. You're serving a great product to your customers or your family. You're not helping some CEO buy a jet boat and a second home and pay for a bunch of unmentionable things that I won't get into on this podcast. You know, when you buy from us, you're helping us get the ranch foreman's daughter some new shoes and some dance lessons. You know, you're helping us remodel our historical house. You're helping us maintain this land. You're helping me buy diapers for my daughter, right? You're helping us take care of our community. And you're helping us keep money in our community so that it doesn't become any more of a ghost town than it already is.
So spot on. I'm obviously a apparel brand, and that's just another industry. All of these different industries, I mean, the huge industrial boom for major cities, and once everything just essentially got shipped off to nowhere in America, it's just, like you're saying, it's ending disasters. I do want to rewind a little bit to the topic of the restaurants, because you mentioned that there's a couple times that they stopped what they were doing immediately. I was wondering if you just give an example of, I guess, a situation with a restaurant that didn't go so well, just because with all the listeners, most people aren't unaware of just how tough agriculture is in terms of what you're trying to do with restaurants and grocery stores, because they are very fickle. They might overpromise and underdeliver. They might just screw you over entirely and cut the contract when you already had the food ready. And then that just decimates your business.
No, that's a real thing. That's a scary thing. And it's a place that we found ourselves in several times. And I'm trying to think of the right example because there's so many. But I think I'll start with the example of a grocery store, right? So walk into you want to target a single owner grocery store. Can you hear me? Okay. Mm-hmm. So you want to target a single owner grocery store, either an IGA or a little natural food store, whatever, right? Something where you can go and meet with the owner because he's there every day. He's actually involved. He can make decisions. So if they have a fresh meat counter, it's going to go really bad for us because we're frozen meat. We don't have the supply chain to support fresh meat. It's just not financially possible. So what happens is we bring in a sample. The owner cooks it up at his house. He loves it. He wants to bring it in. He thinks it's going to do so well. And then so he puts in a huge order, $3,000-$4,000, which is a lot of money for a single owner business to spend on a new product. So we come in, we talk to some of his people, this is how it works. You guys should really try it out. And then what happens a lot of times is in the stores, it'll just sit there in the back corner of some place. Like we had a place where they were buying fairly consistently, but their case was always messed up. And then I would come in to check on stuff and they would yell at me about how I'm not stocking their case right and I'm not keeping it organized. And I'm like, guys, I'm a three-man operation. I am not going to stock your store shelves for you. Okay. And we ended up finally dropping them because they put in a big restock. Stuff was finally selling really well with them. And they put in a big restock in order and they were finally taking care of their own shelves and they get their order in. And then they call me and they demand that I refund them for the order they just paid for because they found a bunch of other stuff in inventory and that I was taking advantage of them. And I'm like, guys, I need you as a customer. Why would I take advantage of you when I need every cent I can because I'm building a business and it's not I already know you guys are terrible at inventory. I try to check stuff for you because you don't do it. Okay. But you have 7 walk-in freezers in the store and stuff buried everywhere. You want me to rifle through every box in your entire store and spend 5 hours here doing your inventory? You called me, you put in an order, we brought it in, you paid for it. Now you want me to refund you because you didn't know what you had in stock in your store. I'm not doing that. And we just dropped them as a customer right there. I said, you guys have been nothing but problems. And honestly, the headache is becoming more than it's worth. And we've had people that were buying our stuff from that store find us online and start buying stuff from our web store because they loved our product so much.
That's awesome. I'm curious then on the restaurant side, if you have any stories to share on that, because I know that's a whole different beast when compared to just restaurants or
restaurants grocery stores. Restaurants are logistically tough, man. The best thing I can tell any other farmers that are listening is you want to find a nicer restaurant if you have any in your area, especially if you know the owners or the waitresses or whatever. Just try to talk to them and see if you can bring in something as a special. Make sure they know it's USDA certified, and that's what I recommend, because especially if you're not doing a ton of animals, you can bring in a Tuesday special and a Thursday special if it's a bigger place, or you can every couple weeks be like, hey guys, can we run a special with some of my beef every couple weeks? You'd really be helping me out. You know, we've been eating in here for 10 years. I love this place and I'd love to be able to bring my wife and my kids down and order the steak from our ranch and say, guys, this was, this is from us. And they're like, what? And that's a good way to do that with restaurants. But they're logistically tough and they can be finicky and restaurant staffs have huge turnovers. So I'll give another example. We had a restaurant, one of our very first customers. The owner wasn't that interested, but his head chef was amazing. I would say his name, but he probably doesn't want me to, but he's amazing. He ended up moving on to a way better position for UC Berkeley. and he's bringing us with him, but he's not quite ready yet. But he was amazing to us, and he cooked this pork chop, and this pork chop he bought from us for 18 months while he worked there. It became legendary. People were calling us to tell us how good this pork chop was that they had. They were doing a great job of promoting it. It was properly labeled on the menu. The staff loved it. I mean, we'd go out on Saturday to get some drinks after lunch or whatever, and we'd see one of the waitresses from that restaurant, and she's like, "Oh my God, you're the pork chop people. That thing is so good." You know, and it feels great when somebody's like, "That's the best pork chop I've ever eaten." But you know, they transition, they get a new guy on, and they're bringing on a new chef while I'm firing a guy because he's messing up customer orders and he's disrespecting customers. He's disrespecting the other people that work here. I'm like, dude, look, I brought you on here because you were a soldier like I was. You said you just needed a leg up. We were trying to do that for you. We got you a place to live. We're paying a lot of your bills, blah, 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 blah. When you need money, we cut you a check. You know, we're kind of strapped for cash. So you're like half woofing, half just working here for a place to live. You know, we got him a fifth wheel trailer that was nice when he got it, but it just started to go downhill fast. So he messed up like two orders for this restaurant that was one of our best customers, right? He messed up like two orders for this new chef. And then I fire him for a bunch of other reasons, not just for that. And then my head is so messed up about like how I feel like I've betrayed my friend that I'm not paying attention and I'm just trying to fix this order that's messed up. And I brought in the wrong order like twice to the same place because my head just wasn't in the game, right? And after that, they just dropped us. And that really falls on us, right? A little bit. But it was just disappointing because we'd been working with them for 18 months and they just dropped us. There's another one last year. They were going to open up a big barbecue pit thing and they put in a big order with us for like pork bellies and sausages and all this stuff. And that just never came to fruition. And they've been buying some stuff. And then after that fell apart, they just, every time I've gone in there, just cold shoulder. Oh, it's this guy, you know? So I just stopped bothering with them. But the one restaurant that gets me the most, most worked up, I was in there getting a haircut and I met the owner of this restaurant and he just bought out his partner. So it's just him and his wife now. And I've been bringing them samples and trying to get working with them. They're like the nicest restaurant in our town, right? And he shakes. I'm talking to him. He's like, "No, we'd love to bring on some local sausages." And I told him the price. He's like, "No, that's fine." Shakes my hand. He promises to buy X amount. He buys one box. We had all these sausages made for him on this handshake deal. He bought one box of sausages and he has been ignoring us ever since. But I still text him and email him every week just because. So. But yeah, that one really made me mad because he shook my hand. He guaranteed that he was going to buy X amount of product. We brought in a bunch of product for him and he never bought any of it. And like you were saying, that's the danger of restaurants is, yeah, they can be all about it one minute and then the next day they drop you and you never hear from them again.
Dang. Well, thank you for sharing those stories because that's one thing I haven't talked about enough on this podcast or just logistics, but then also, I mean, a lot of the folks I've had on are just direct to consumer, but haven't talked restaurants and grocery stores because yeah, that's just a whole nother beast of things. No,
and everyone's logistical chain and everyone's situation is different. Everyone's opportunity is different. You know, I don't think we would be able to do what we're doing if we weren't located where we are. You know, the state of California is huge and there's maybe two or three operations in the state that we compete with for premium pork. And everyone kind of has their region. There's a North Cal guy. There's a Southern California guy. And all of a sudden, Llano Seco, which was our Central California competitor, they shut down. So it's just us and that no one has that, you know, that's just luck. That that's just luck. And the other side of the luck is we have a great product. We have a very competitive price for that product. And we've gotten very good at finding out who to sell that to. And that goes back to a basic marketing technique, which is just who is your customer, right? You got to figure out who's your customer. My customer is health conscious moms and dads. My customer is Michelin star restaurants. My customer is very committed natural food stores. Those are my three customers. Everyone else, they might buy it one time and they're going to go, cool, we supported America, we supported local, and then they're never going to buy it again. So they're going to go, it was too expensive. You know, I didn't care that much, but you know, I'm glad we supported those guys. That's probably 90% of our sales interactions go just like that. So we really had to narrow down those three things. Who are our three biggest customers? Health conscious moms and dads, Michelin star restaurants, and very committed health food stores that are single owner. Single owner is a huge part of that.
Is that because if there's just multiple, that just adds complexity? And I'm curious why.
Because if it's multiple stores, it's more complex. The owner's more removed from the day-to-day operation. And there's a lot more chiefs and Indians in those places. So you might have one guy that's like, hell yeah, we're going to do it. And then you got two other guys that are like, what the fuck? This is twice the price of the normal stuff. Sorry again for cussing, but that's just kind of how that goes, man. We've tried grocery store chains that had just two or three that were still owned by one guy or one family. And those are so messy. Even the single owner ones can be really messy sometimes. So I would say if you're direct to consumer and you're looking for a store, you want to find a store that doesn't have a butcher case. And you want to find a store that's organically, naturally, regeneratively minded products. And you want to find a store that's single owner. The issue with those three things is that's usually not a very big store. So you're not going to see tons of volumes from that place typically. But you're going to get your product out to the people that are looking for it. And you're going to help rebuild that supply chain on a local level. And you're going to bring in just a little bit of money for your operation. So even if it's only enough to buy a new set of truck tires or make an insurance payment or get a tank of gas, that stuff adds up. And it's those little customers, honestly, that are my favorites. That's who I have the best relationship with, you know?
Yeah. So whenever you're documenting everything throughout this whole process, since you've started, are there things that you wish you would have done better through all of this?
Yeah, I actually, this just clicked for me about 45 days ago when I was looking at our field the day before we did a load of hogs. And I was looking at the soil, and our soil 20 years ago was depleted red clay. It was just red clay. Think your standard Texas red dirt clay. That's exactly what our soil looks like here. It's depleted from gold mining. It's depleted from overuse. It's depleted from all sorts of different stuff. So it's just hard packed red clay. In the winter, it's 12 inches deep of soaking wet clay. And in the summer, it's as hard as concrete. And I did not do a good job of monitoring the changes in the soil. And I was looking at it the other day, and it's no longer red clay in the winter. It's still clay. You still sink, but I can tell the level of organic matter is going up a lot because when it's loaded with water, A, my feet don't sink down as deep. So our root systems and our mycelium is stronger, but it's also turning purple of all things. And as it's going through different hues of purple, and then it's starting to turn darker and darker every year. So we've really been implementing these practices on a big scale for 3 years. We plan on expanding on that a lot. And just to see the difference it's made in those two or three depleted old fields that have been getting worked for a century or more. To see the difference in just 3 years, I can't wait to see what that difference looks like in 10 years. That's the number one thing I wish I had done a better job of documenting, was the changes in the soil. We had a huge increase in bird species here. The first year it was swallows, thousands of swallows. I mean, an unbelievable number of them. And they actually, before we had swallows, we only had hornets. We had hornets and turkeys. And the swallows and the hornets actually occupy the same spaces. So the swallows showed up because of the pig wallowing pits, the big pits of water on the ground that the pigs roll around in. So the swallows love that because there's worms and bugs and water right there that they can play in and stuff. So they showed up by the thousands, and they brought our out of control hornet population we used to spend 2 weeks a year dealing with. They brought that under control. So now we have a normal amount of hornets. And then we had that explosion in the swallow population, and then that actually went back into balance too. We had a huge explosion in the mouse and rat population. So I went out to my friend's house and got some of her feral cats, threw those up at my barn. That's brought my rat population into balance, right? We had a huge issue with predators. As dumb as this is going to sound, I have Siberian huskies here. And I have two males, and they both have their testicles. But the reason why is because their urine and the way they sound at night wards off other predators. So when they run around and pee on stuff, the coyotes and the mountain lions and the bears go, oh, crap, wolves. And then when they howl at night and make all sorts of dumb sounds and stuff, that has the same effect. So we don't have much of a predation problem anymore since those guys hit puberty and have started peeing on everything. Before they hit puberty, I had a bunch of goats. We were going to go into start doing goat meat, and we had a mountain lion and her two cubs came in every day for like 14 days, just decimated our goat population. We were down to just one goat from like 25. So
that's interesting. I've never heard with huskies, Siberian huskies. That's really interesting, especially now that you're saying you can tell the differences between pre and post. Urine. That's interesting.
No, I know. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. And I'll always remember the last time the mountain lions came out, because those two boys were freaking out in my house, freaking out. So I opened the door and they ran into the woods, and then they would come back and they would freak out outside the house, and I'd open the door. And this is going on at like midnight, 1 a.m., 2:30. I'm like, guys, I'm not doing this. And they ran out and came back like three times. And finally, I grabbed a flashlight and I went to follow them. And they had treed a mountain lion in a thicket of woods. And I was like, dudes, no, I'm not following you, A, into there, and or B, dealing with that. You can figure that out. Ever since that night, we have had no mountain lions here. And same thing with the coyotes. They chased off one coyote, and there have been no coyotes since.
You were mentioning how with the soil changes, especially with all the practices implemented the previous 2 to 3 years, can you talk more on everything that you've been doing to just try to help improve the soil quality?
Man, that's a layered question. So different types of flowers, rotating the animals around, trying to keep all of the different fodders and stuff that we grow, get that to the animals, one, so their digestive tracts process it, but also just their poop is great. So we have goat poop and horse poop and pig poop everywhere in all the fields. And we rotate everyone through based off what the different stuff is looking like. We've actually been able to use goats and pigs to pretty much eradicate our star thistle. We only have a few patches of that left, which if you don't know, and I've seen the weeds in the pokey weeds in Arizona, that stuff is rough. But the star thistle is like this gross little green plant, and it grows these little barbs, and they'll poke through your pants, and there's a little oil on there or something, and it just stings forever. But it's got a super aggressive root system, and it just takes over when one gets started. It just multiplies, and it's almost impossible to eradicate. And we've almost eradicated all of it. And it's one of those things where normally I wouldn't eradicate a plant species, but this stuff is so aggressive, I just want it gone. So there's that. Another thing that we've been doing is there's a thing called the bark beetle. It's killing tons of pine trees. And then there's also the issue with the wildfires in California. So as the tree crews go around and they cut down all these dead or burned trees, or they clear space to prevent wildfires, they usually chip them up. And so what we do is we'll have them bring us loads of chips because they don't have anywhere to dispose it. So they'll bring us loads of chips for free. We spread that out all over the ranch on walkways and through the gardens and in the pastures. And the rate at which that stuff decomposes is incredible. I mean, within 60 days, it's starting to turn black and add all sorts of carbon and nutrients to the soil. And then it's super dense in mushrooms. So we get a lot of like mycelium stuff growing up out of it. And then there's also a couple of older ladies that come and trade us flower seeds for pork. So they'll pick old patches of wildflowers from around their house and they'll save the seeds. And every year they'll bring us a bucket of seeds or whatever. And we just walk out there and throw them out in March and April. And if they sprout, they sprout. And so we're starting to add a lot of different wildflowers in. We've also brought in some different vetches and things and just kind of spread it around randomly.
Just have to start sprouting now?
Yeah, no, there's this year in front of the shop here actually is the first year where that the random wildflower stuff is really going crazy out there. I mean, there's a lot of flowers I've never seen before. And so really just try to create a good environment for plants and let the rest of it go from there. I think if the plants are happy, they'll make the soil happy. Well, I guess if the soil's happy, then plants happy, the plants make the animals happy, and the animals make the soil happy again. The only issue is overgrazing because we're stuck on our three main big paddocks right now. Because we're kind of in a hit a financial barrier where the cost of fencing in more space is not possible at this time. So we really are careful with how many animals are on which spots for how long to make sure they don't overgraze.
Yeah, no.
And I think that's
interesting too. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, man. I wish I had like some really deep wisdom about the soil. But all I can say is happy soil makes happy plants, and happy plants make happy animals, and happy animals make happy soil. That's how I explain it to the farm hands. So
with the thorn bush that you're explaining to, is that a native species? Because I know on the topic of soil health, a lot of times invasive species come out of nowhere, and that's not, I shouldn't say out of nowhere, it's because the soil underneath is all out of balance with the microbiology, and then that can cause these invasive weeds to grow.
So I've heard it both ways. I've heard that it's an invasive species from China. So during the gold rush, it was coming over on the boats coming from China, and it got started in the San Francisco Bay, and it just has worked its way east. I've also heard that it is a local natural plant, but I find that hard to believe that it is natural to this area, just because there's no bug will eat it. No animal will eat it. No other weed can compete with it for space. And typically those would be signs to me of an invasive species. Because if it was native to some area for 50,000 years, there'd be a beetle or something that ate this. And the only thing that eats it for some reason is pigs and goats. They love it, which is good for me, right? But like the deer won't touch it. Horses won't touch it. Bugs won't touch it. So to me, I think it represents the characteristics of an invasive species, but I've had horticulturalists tell me it's invasive, and I've had horticulturalists tell me it's natural or it's supposed to be here. So I'm not a horticulturalist. I don't know, but I think it has the signs of an invasive species.
Sounds like it's me.
Yeah. Right. Nothing's eating it.
Well, thank you for all this. This was a great conversation, Sam.
You can find the full video on YouTube at The Renaissance.